Welcome to Two-Way Street. I'm Bill Nygut. Today we're going to talk about the life and music of the great American jazz singer Billie Holiday. We're going to do it through the lens of the musical Lady Day at Emerson's Bar and Grill, which is now running at Atlanta's Theatrical Outfit Theater. It's a one-woman show based on a real event. Billie Holiday performed at Emerson in Philadelphia just 3 months before she died in July of 1959. Philadelphia is the town where Holiday was arrested for heroin possession and subsequently was sentenced to a year in federal prison. And so on this particular evening where the show is set, she's haunted by the memories of past triumphs and failures. As she moves from story to story and song to song, Holiday drinks heavily and at one point excuses herself to leave the room and apparently to get a drug fix. It's a demanding role for any actress and singer, requiring an ability to capture the unique vocal approach Holiday took to her music and to run the gamut of emotions that unfold as we hear the stories of Holiday's life, even while appearing to get increasingly intoxicated and eventually stoned. Atlanta actress and singer Terry Burrell plays the part in the Theatrical Outfit production, and we're really glad that you are here with us today, Terry. And we've also asked to come in one of our great guests, composer, musician, Emory University professor of African American music, and minister, Dwight Andrews. Terry and Dwight, thank you so much for being here to talk about Billie Holiday today.
It's a pleasure.
It's great to be with you.
Let's start with the very beginning of her career. She, as an 18-year-old girl, was performing in a club in Harlem, and the great producer, blues and jazz producer John Hammond, went up to the club to see another artist perform, and he saw Billie Holiday, and apparently immediately fell in love with her music.
Well, it was very interesting that when she first started to sing, it was not the torch song kind of singer that she became later.
Dwight, why was John Hammond so important to African-American music in those days?
Well, John Hammond is really an interesting figure. He played a really prominent role in not only programming various important jazz musicians, but putting combinations of musicians together. So Hammond is credited with helping convince Benny Goodman to integrate his band with Teddy Wilson and with Billie Holiday. And so he's a kind of behind-the-scenes person, but he creates these concerts and programs, oftentimes with these very, very powerful combinations, many of which have life-changing and career-changing implications.
He was a producer for Columbia Records,
yes,
I believe,
yeah,
and introduced the world to great many African-American artists particularly.
That's exactly right.
And so he put Billie Holiday together with the Benny Goodman Orchestra, and in, I think, November of 1933, the world first heard on a record Billie Holiday sing this song. So, Terry, you've been working on that song is Your Mother's Son-in-Law, which is a really funny title for a song. You said when we started to talk about this song, this is a different sound from Billie Holiday. In a few minutes, we're going to hear the sound that you have to channel in your performance. But she started out in a different mode altogether.
Yeah, when I first heard this recording, I had to check and make sure that I had the right CD because I thought it was Ethel Waters that was that was singing. And then, of course, when I started doing my research, I realized that later on, her whole persona and sound changed.
It's funny that Terry Dwight would mention Ethel Waters the last time she was here for Two-Way Street. She came in to talk about a one-woman show she was doing at the time at the Alliance Theater, that in which she played Ethel Waters. So thank you for reminding us
of that. No, I mean, really, when I heard it, because I spent so much time listening to Ethel, that I was just shocked that it sounded so much like her.
Yeah. We know that two of the great, great influences in her childhood were Bessie Smith and Louis Armstrong. But it's the way in which she heard those artists on record that helps tell the story about her life. There was only one Victrola. I think at that point she was living in Baltimore. And as a young girl, the only record player she could use was where?
At a sporting house or whorehouse.
Yeah.
You know, as they were called in those days.
Yeah.
And as she says in the show, she said, you know, that was the only place where white folks and colored folks could meet. They sure couldn't meet in no church.
Let's listen to just a little of Bessie Smith singing a song that you actually perform in Lady Day at Emerson's Bar and Grill. Give me a pig foot and a can of beer. Not a can of beer. Dwight, what was Bessie Smith's place in the world of music in those days?
She was a very, very important and seminal figure in the classic blues period. The 1920s, Bessie Smith and Ma Rainey, Ethel Waters, Mamie Smith, they really introduced in many ways the black woman blues singer to the world. And the classic blues really revolutionized the early record industry because they were selling hundreds and thousands of copies of these blues singers singing these songs about men and love lost. And Bessie Smith was truly one of the most successful of all of the classic blues singers. She was reared under Ma Rainey, but then she went on to introduce and to influence many of the subsequent singers like Billie Holiday.
Terry, in the show, you sing as Billie Holiday.
I do.
Give me a pigfoot and a bottle of beer. What's the context in which you sing that song? You talk about your love for Bessie Smith.
Yeah, she was so heavily influenced by Bessie. And there's a moment when she turns to the piano player and she says, let's give me a little Bessie. Give me a little pigfoot, you know? And that's when she sings that song, you know?
But she sings it. How does she sing it? Her phrasing is so unique. Her stylization of songs is so different. Even she may have been influenced by Bessie.
And some of the words are a little different. Yeah. You know, like she'll say things. And what they do is a whoop-a-da. Oh, Hannah Brown, way across town. You know, she had this way of elongating certain words, and it's really a study.
So I want to talk about that, and we'll come back to the history of her life. But we essentially, as your audience, are sitting in Emerson's Bar and Grill in Philadelphia in 1959, I think.
Yes, about 3 months before her death.
And Emerson's was a somewhat freighted place to her. What does she say about being back in Philadelphia?
She says, it's been the rat's ass for me. I told everybody, when I die, I don't care if I go to heaven or hell, long as it ain't Philly.
But we do see her do essentially your portrayal of her, do a set of her music. And I want to talk a little bit about how you reached the point where you were able to some extent, give us Billie Holiday, while I assume doing your own interpretation of Holiday, too. We should talk about that. And if you don't mind, to do that, I want to listen to one of my favorite songs, certainly from the show, but also of Billie Holiday's in general, What a Little Moonlight Can Do.
Oh, what a little moonlight can do. What little moonlight can do to you? You're in love, your hearts are fluttering all day long. You only started 'cause you're poor tongue. Just real light out of the way.
There's these phrasings that are so, you said it, she elongates, she bounces through a song. How do you describe and how do you manage to capture that?
Well, you have to study it and get as close as you can to it. And then I had to remind myself that I'm not Billie Holiday. I don't sing like Billie Holiday, but I can give you Billie-isms. And then you have to be able to tell the story through singing the song. So it's a combination of all of those things. And you never perfect it, but every time I'm able to perform it, I get just a little bit closer because I'm listening to it every single day.
So how does What a Little Moonlight Would Do sound sung through Terry Burrell?
Pretty close.
Yeah.
Ooh. What a little moonlight can do to you. You know, you have to just relax it. And she's got that ow.
You know, Dwight, Billie Holiday had her influences like Bessie Smith and Louis Armstrong, but you never can miss Billie Holiday's voice when you hear it come on the radio, when you hear her song. You know immediately this is Billie Holiday. So she became her own person as a singer.
Absolutely. You know, the amazing thing about Billie Holiday is that she is the quintessential jazz artist, because all great jazz artists have their own individual voice. I mean, Bessie Smith did not sound like Ma Rainey, and those that came after Louis Armstrong did not sound like Louis. They took all of what Louis gave, and then they made it their own, and then they had to come on the other side with their own unique voice. That's one of the things that makes Billie Holiday so powerful. You only have to listen to one phrase, and you know immediately who it is.
That's
and you
right.
don't confuse her with anything else. And so I've always marveled at the way in which our jazz great artists all have their own individual voice, no matter whether you're a singer or an instrumentalist. You know John Coltrane when you hear him. You know mm-hmm. Miles when you hear him. And it's because they perfected, oh, that's Miles. Mm-hmm. And so Billie was, of all the great singers, she, like Ella Fitzgerald, she put her stamp on everything she sang and made it her own. So I remind all young jazz students that it's not about imitating someone else, but it's about studying them.
That's right.
As Terry says, so thoroughly that you can then use that as your foundation to then make the voice your own.
And she says in the show, she said, I'm what I do is the blues feeling with the jazz beat. Mm-hmm. She wanted that feeling that she got when she listened to Louis Armstrong, Pops mm-hmm. Armstrong. And she wanted Bessie's big sound, but she didn't have that kind of a voice. She had a very small voice.
She did love Louis Armstrong. And one of the records that she no doubt listened to when she was young, which would have been in the 20s,
mm-hmm.
right?
That's right.
Louis Armstrong was obviously recording and already a major figure in jazz music. And she would have probably heard him play West End Blues.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Louis Armstrong. You know, Dwight, she says in her autobiography, Lady Sings the Blues, which eventually was made into a movie that many people saw with Diana Ross playing Billie Holiday. She says that when she listened to Pops, she called him Pops, when she listened to Louis Armstrong, she said, it was the first time I ever heard anybody sing without using any words.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes, yes. And absolutely, that's the case. I think that there's a reason why musicians, young and old, still listen to Pops because of the way in which he told the story without any words. And even when he sang like he played. So, you know, he, much like Billie Holiday and Bessie Smith, is what he did with the time, with the beat. He could speed it up, slow it down, but he stayed always in the groove in a way that really told a story.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Speeding up, slowing down. One of the things, Terry, that I think about when I hear Billie Holiday is there are times when she is singing a number where I feel as if she is in complete command, totally confident, and does not mind the fact that the way in which she's approaching a phrase is not necessarily the way you would normally hear the song sung. In other words, she's confident that the orchestra may be doing one thing, and she takes her own time getting in and out
she'll
of a phrase.
Off
does
the
that
beat.
Make sense?
Yes, she'll sing off the beat, you know, and without dropping words, without dropping sentences, you know, the full sentences, so that it makes sense. That music, though, when you listen to it, she talks about that wanting that Lewis feeling. It's so sensual and grown up. You know, maybe that's why the population spiked then.
One of the other things that I think of when I think of Billie Holiday is her posture, her physicalization. She had a way of holding her neck, for instance. She held her held back often. She doesn't seem entirely relaxed as a physical presence. Does that make sense to you?
I understand what you're saying. Yes, and that's where you have to decide where you're going to impose your own sense of body language. You know, this was not a woman who moved a lot when she would sing, but Terry moves, and I'm and I'm telling the story, and it is a depiction of a person. So there are times when I'm singing when I will move.
Yeah, I can't imagine Terry Burrell standing still the way Billie Holiday would have singing What a Little Moonlight Can Do. You're jumping around. You were jumping around in your seat here in the studio. Let's do this. Let's take a break. And when we come back, I want to talk about her life and her hard times. And I want to talk about some of it through the music that she performed and that you, Terry Burrell, perform in Lady Day at Emerson's Bar and Grill. So we'll be back in a moment with Terry Burrell and Emory University Professor Dwight Andrews after this break.
Up in a Harlem every Saturday night, when the highbrows get together, it's just too right. They all congregate.
If you're just joining us, my guests today on Two Way Street are actress and singer Terry Burrell. She's playing the role of Billie Holiday in the one-woman show based on one of Holiday's final club dates before she died. The show is called Lady Day at Emerson's Bar and Grill, and it's now running at Atlanta's Theatrical Outfit Theater. Joining us in the studio to talk about Billie Holiday and her place in American jazz music, Emory University Professor of African American Music, composer, and minister Dwight Andrews. Let's talk about her life. Terry, this show, so here we are at one of her final club dates before dying 3 months later. She died, what did she actually die of? I mean, she'd been poisoning herself with drugs and alcohol.
Yes.
And essentially, that's really what killed her, isn't it?
Yes. I think she had problems with her liver.
Yes.
And
cirrhosis of the liver.
Cirrhosis of the liver.
Was the actual.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So she plays this date, and throughout the show, you tell us stories from her life. One of the songs that is, of course, her most famous songs, God Bless the Child.
Yes.
I want to tell the story of how she wrote that song, but first, you say an interesting thing playing Billie Holiday in the show. You talk about the fact that everybody always wants you to sing that song. Billie Holiday is not Billie Holiday without singing in a concert, in a club date, God Bless the Child. It feels like, obviously, the song, you must love the song, but it's also like, I've got to sing it. It's a burden as well.
Well, what happened after a while is that in the contract, she would have to do certain songs like Strange Fruit and God Bless the Child. But she was not the kind of artist that would just walk out on the stage and just sing a bunch of songs. She sang according to how she felt in the moment. And she said, I got to sort of roam around a bit and find a song. I'm all I like the song, find me. You know, so that's why her pianist, Jimmy Powers, was so important to her, because he kept her in line and made sure that she sang the numbers she was supposed to.
She wrote God Bless the Child.
Yes, she did.
And tell me if I'm wrong. The story goes that she wrote it about her own mother, who was a teenager when she gave birth to Billy.
Yes.
And it came after her mother, she wanted to borrow money, I think, from her mother. Have I got this right?
Yes. She was involved with a man, the man who actually introduced her to heroin, Sonny Monroe. And as she says, we were bad too. We need a little moonlight, maybe a moonbeam or two. Mm-hmm. And she asked her mother, they were all living together, could she have some money? And she told her no. She said, not as long as you're with him. I will not give you the money. And it really hurt Billy, because Billy worked from the time she was a little girl, you know, to help her mother. And she had helped her mother open a restaurant and all of that. And it really hurt her. And they moved out. And she wrote the song. And she said it always made her mad, because she knew I wrote it for her. She knew.
What'd she call her mother?
Duchess.
Duchess. Mm-hmm.
And it was actually her good buddy, Lester Young, who played
the great saxophone player.
That's right. They were best friends. And he's the one who gave her mother that moniker.
Dwight, it is hard to underestimate the importance of God Bless the Child in the history of contemporary American music.
No question about it, both because of the words, the very words of the song, but it's become a part of the jazz canon and the jazz standard. It's interesting, though, because in many ways it reflects kind of this very complicated and tragic life of Billie Holiday, but it also has an air of triumph, God Bless the Child, has its own or her own.
While we're talking God Bless the Child, let's listen first to Billie Holiday sing a little of this extraordinary song, God Bless the Child.
Them that's got shall have, them that's not shall lose. So the Bible said, and it still is news. Mama may have, Papa may have, but God bless the child that's got his own, that's got his own. Yes, the strong gets more, while the weak ones fade. Empty
pockets. Delicious. Just
Papa
delicious.
May have, Mama may have.
But God bless the child that's got his own.
And it became, again, one of the great songs in American jazz music. We do want to talk about the influences in her life. Sonny Monroe, who you mentioned already, being one in the most negative way imaginable. But as you point out, she had a relationship with one of the greatest jazz saxophone players in music.
That's absolutely right, with the great tenor saxophonist Lester Young. And I always thought that their relationship was in part based on their struggles. Both of them had struggles with drugs and with addiction, and also the ways in which the world had not always treated them very well. And so I think they empathized with each other on a kind of profound level. But I can't remember where the quote comes from, but Someone asked Billie Holiday why she sang the way she did, and she said, I just listened to Lester. I listened to the Prez. And then someone interviewed Prez, and he said, I just listened to Billie Holiday.
Prez is what they called Lester.
That's
she
right.
She called him Prez.
That's right.
And she called him Prez,
and he called
named
Lady Day.
The Lady Day. That's
and,
right.
And why Lady Day? Do we know?
I don't really know why he called her that.
Yeah, I think it was in part because this idea of royalty.
Yes.
We had Count, we had Duke, we had Earl, mm-hmm. and we have the lady because she really was a lady.
Let's get it right. She named him Prez.
Yes.
He named her Lady Day, and it was Lester Young who named Billie Holiday's mother
Duchess.
So, that's right. So we had the royal court.
So they really had this remarkably close relationship.
He lived with them
for a while.
Yes, he did.
They weren't lovers, but
no.
just great, good friends.
Yes, and then they eventually, that relationship was strained because of her drug use.
Yeah. Sonny Monroe was a poisonous influence. Who was Sonny Monroe?
Sonny Monroe, as she says in the show, was her first love and her worst love. But what was interesting was that I read that she never blamed him for her drug addiction. She accepted responsibility for it. She said, I made the choice to use the drugs. So nobody should blame him. He was like a little boy to her. You know, she called him my little man child, my little sweetie. She loved children, and she never had any children. So he was like, he fulfilled, I think, some kind of maternal need. And she married him to spite her mother.
Hmm. She did struggle with addiction throughout her life. She may not have blamed it on him, but as far as we know, it was Sonny Monroe who first introduced her
to heroin.
To
yes.
heroin, right? Mm-hmm. There is a very, speaking of all that, there's a very moving section of the show, Terry, in which you talk about the way in which Billie Holiday faced racial prejudice. You tell the story, she was a breakthrough artist in that
yes.
she was the first African-American singer to go out on the road with a white jazz orchestra.
With Artie Shaw.
She went out with Artie Shaw.
Mm-hmm.
And in the show, you tell us, as Billie, a very poignant story about coming south.
Well, she says they went on tour, and they started out in Boston. And she had to sit on the bus in these places, Virginia, North Carolina, Georgia even. She would have to sit and wait on the bus until it was her turn to sing because they didn't want a black woman sitting on the bandstand with all those white guys.
And at one point in the South, and I'm not sure where this took place, maybe mm-hmm. you can tell us, there's a really a very amusing story in many ways. It's painful and then amusing about what happens when Artie Shaw, who apparently was very open to having an African-American singer with the band, supported her. She couldn't come into the dining room of the venue they were playing.
It was a restaurant in Birmingham, Alabama.
So he paid for everyone in the band to sit with her
in the kitchen. Yes. And that's the way the band treated her. If she couldn't walk through the front door, they didn't either. If she had to, and she would have to eat in the kitchen, they all ate out there too. And he paid, they had to pay to eat. And he paid double the price for all of them, and she had to use the bathroom. And they wouldn't let her use the bathroom. And if you want to find out how she used the bathroom, you're going to have to come and see the show. But she used the bathroom.
Oh, Terry, you're a promoter every second. It is a very funny story that has to do with the way it's described in the show, a white hostess at the restaurant not allowing Billie Holiday to use the restroom. It's not funny, and then it becomes very funny. But Dwight, this was a barrier that African-American artists faced throughout the 20th century when they played in venues that had white audiences. And,
absolutely. The South had a terrible reputation for all jazz musicians coming from the Northeast, not only because of segregation, but because of the treatment overall. Remember, they could play venues that they couldn't stay in some of these hotels. They had to stay with other families, with other black families. Segregation was the blight of the South, and it kept many artists from coming south. South, because not only because of segregation and Jim Crow, but you have to remember that lynching was still a very, very much a part of the Southern culture, and many people were too afraid to come South. I always think that for jazz musicians who struggled to be able to perform on the very stage where they couldn't stay, that some of the challenges with addictions and how do you numb yourself so that you can be on stage in a place where you're not accepted as a human being, I think imposed its own kind of dramatic weight on our artists, who we expected them to be up when they're on stage, but to have to deal with all of this other racist stuff, I'll put it that way.
I actually read a story of her when she was touring with the Count Basie band. And I don't remember the venue, but they said, management said she was too light-skinned. Oh. And they didn't want the audience to think that there was a white woman singing, so she had to darken her skin to sing with them.
Yeah.
And after a while, when that's repeatedly happening, it does play a number with your head.
Throughout the show, Billie has harsh words for white people. She has struggled with them, obviously, throughout her life, and so she talks about them being mean and has other very disparaging remarks to make about white people, doesn't she?
She does, but the audience laughs with her.
Yeah.
You know?
All right, all of this brings us to one of the emotional high points of the show, and certainly one of the most important moments in her career, because this was the song that really put her on the map in many ways. The song is called Strange Fruit. You sing Strange Fruit in the show after telling us the Artie Shaw story, after talking about how you've been treated by white people, Billie. What is the song Strange Fruit?
It was a poem that was brought to her. I don't remember the name of the poet.
Lewis Allen.
Yes, right.
And
that was his pseudonym.
Yes.
And they put music to it. She recorded it, and there were venues that didn't want her to sing the song. It was a protest song. That's what it was.
It's a shocking song, Dwight. The first time I heard Strange Fruit, I was shocked. I was stunned to think of the images in that song being used in a popular music song. What is Strange Fruit about?
Well, Strange Fruit really is about the lynching and the reality of lynching in the South, and it takes all of the imagery of this strange fruit, the bulging eyes, the mouth of a lynched person, and it characterizes and dramatizes that scene in such a poignant way. When I play it for students, they are almost stunned into silence because the images, the rotting nature of a corpse, and to see this in the setting of a popular song. The reality was, it wasn't a popular song. It wasn't played on some radio stations.
Yes, yeah.
It became a song that could be played in concert, but not everywhere. It really grew out of a relationship with many jazz artists and the so-called left, the socialist left, in New York City, where there were songs of protest, songs of social commentary. And it brought the weight of that onto a recording, which she reluctantly did after some coaxing.
Let's listen to Billie Holiday as she sings Strange Fruit. Scene of the gallant South, the bulging eyes and the twisted mouth, scent of magnolia sweet and fresh, and then the sudden
smell of burning flesh.
Oh.
You know, my father grew up in the South, And my uncle is 92 years old, and he shared stories with me of his father taking him into the woods and showing him places where they would literally pour hot tar on the skins of black men for whatever reason, and then pour feathers on them. Mm. And whenever I sing that song, I see that image. Yeah. It came alive for me to hear it coming from my relative's mouth.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's moving to me about this. It was written by a white guy.
Yes.
Abe Mirapool.
That's right.
A New York City liberal.
Yep. Part of the Jewish left.
Part of that left, who, by the way, in another odd historical twist, is the man who took in the children of Julius and Ethel Rosenberg after the parents were executed as spies. Whoa.
So many important connections. But you know the thing that's really, I think, poignant about this? Here we are in this season of celebrating Martin Luther King with the various travesties that we've been experiencing in the White House. And then many people are not aware of the history of lynching in the South and in the North. But, you know, they used to lynch people in city squares in parts of the South, and they used to put these pictures on postcards, and it would be a public event, a picnic, and to see someone. So it's important that we recall how important these stories and these songs are to who we are as a people, and that we never forget the sound and the smell of this strange fruit.
Yeah. Terry, as the show goes on, Billy helps herself to more and more liquor from the bar. And at one point, she leaves the stage.
Yes.
She keeps saying to her accompanist, as you pointed out, Jimmy, who you said is really the one who is her lodestar, keeps her on track to the extent that he can. And she keeps telling him that she can't do it, right?
The first time she says, I'm not doing so good here. And he's able to say to her, just hang in there and just let's do easy living, you know. But by the time she finishes Strange Fruit, and by the time she's told that story of working in the South and Strange Fruit, she's really now very sick. I was fortunate to be able to sit down with a friend of mine who at one time had a heroin addiction, because I wanted to understand the timing of the drug. When it hits the system, how long would it take? And what did it feel like as you got to the point where you really needed to shoot up again?
Yeah.
So at that point, she would have been extremely nauseous. I mean, really feeling very, very bad.
Yeah, she was still a junkie as she did that. And Jimmy keeps saying, well, we're going to have to take a break because Billy's got to go and got to visit the doctor backstage. Mm-hmm. Tell you what I want to do. I want to talk a little about that arc that you go on. You take us as an audience on of descending into intoxication and then eventually to getting a fix and how that affects as you perform the final scenes of that play. But let's do this. Let's take another break and then continue our conversation about the great, great Billie Holiday with Dwight Andrews, who we appreciate so much for being here, and Terry Burrell. Let's get a break in. This is Two Way Street.
Living for you is easy living. It's easy to live when you're in love, and I'm so in love, there's nothing in life but you.
Welcome back to Two-Way Street. I'm Bill Nygut. Today we're exploring the life and music of the great American jazz singer Billie Holiday. I'm talking with actress and singer Terry Burrell. She's playing the role of Holiday in the one-woman show Lady Day at Emerson's Bar and Grill at Atlanta's Theatrical Outfit Theater. And we're joined by Emory University professor of African American music, composer, and minister Dwight Andrews. Before the break, Terry, we were talking about the fact that you increasingly grow intoxicated and eventually leave the stage, and although it's never talked about directly, clearly, fix and come back under the influence of heroin as well. How does that journey, what does that journey do to you throughout the show?
Well, that's the last huge monologue on the show, and the audience can clearly see track marks in her arm when she enters again.
She's wearing long gloves. She's dressed very elegantly, but she comes back and the glove on one hand is off, and so we see the track marks.
You see the track marks. But I'll tell you something. That part of the show is, it sounds weird to say this, but it's very free. It's very stream of consciousness. It's very free. She is totally free. And she's talking about all kinds of things. The time that she worked as a prostitute in a house in Harlem, you know, she was like 16 years old.
We should mention that, by the way, because it's part of the terribly poignant and sad story of her life. Her mother took her to this house thinking that she was going to be hired as a maid, right?
And she said, but I took one look at those lampshades in that chaise lounge, and I knew what my duties. And then one of the clients hurt her. He hurt her so badly that she bled solid for a week. And she got herself out of there. And that's when she found a place called Pods and Jerry's and went in to get a job as a dancer and was poor at it. And they asked her to sing, and they went crazy. That's when her career took off, you know. And she talks about these things very openly in her book. In her autobiography.
So, as an acting challenge, I think back to my old days as an acting student years ago, and I remember a guy named Charles McGraw, who was one of the great acting teachers in Chicago years and years ago, who used to say, the way you play drunk, when people are drunk, they do their best to not be drunk.
That's right.
It's a challenge.
It is. And you know, and it's a challenge to not, she doesn't want the audience to know that she's high. She doesn't even realize her glove is down. You know, I harken back to what my friend said to me. Because one of the questions I asked was, could you be high and I not know it? And they said, yes. You know, it would take great effort, but yes. But I think in that moment she's totally free because she doesn't even realize the audience is there anymore. She doesn't care what she says. She's a stream of consciousness, and she talks about Sonny actually hiding the drugs in her suitcase when the policemen break the door down to the hotel. And he's afraid that, you know, they're gonna put him in prison because they've got a file on him, and she pleads guilty.
Do we think that's a true story?
I don't know.
Or is that just, so that's the incident that lands her in federal prison for a year and a day, that Sonny Monroe planted the drugs in her suitcase. Whether that's true or just Billie Holiday's way of trying to not take responsibility, going to federal prison was without question a terrible low point in her life, and it changed the arc of her career, didn't it?
It absolutely did. But remember, she had a long history of being in and out of these schools and reformatory schools and all of these kinds of things. But the being institutionalized in a federal prison, I think, was certainly a kind of a dramatic low point for her.
She was in a prison in West Virginia. The name of it, you talk about it in
Alderson.
The show. Alderson. And she describes it as a horrible place to have been. Yeah.
Well, because they sent her cold turkey. And the way they treated a sick person was to tie them to the bedpost tightly. Their wrists and their ankles. And to go through withdrawal like that, I mean, the shakes, the vomiting, the sweating, all of that, it was just horrendous. What I admire so much about people like Billie Holiday was that she never lived her life like a victim, even though she was victimized. She didn't feel inferior to anybody. Okay, so what? So I shoot up. So what? So what if I get drunk? So what? Get over it, basically. I'm grown. I make these choices for myself. I'm not blaming anybody else for it. I'm doing what I want to do. And there's something very admirable about it. You know, she found a way to cope in a world that was just constantly dumping on this woman simply because of the color of her skin. Yeah. That's it.
Dwight, what's her, how do you, is she triumph over all of these things and become the great artist, or do we have to take the good with the bad with her?
Well, I think that this is really a great question for us, and it really raises a larger question for me, and I struggle with Billie Holiday and all of my heroes. I get two messages. What I've learned from the life of a Billie Holiday and a Miles Davis and a John Coltrane is that they all struggled with different kinds of addictions and troubles. But the main thing I think we take away is that the art is always bigger mm-hmm. than the situations, that these people come with their problems and with their strengths and frailties. But the art that they leave and share is so much more than their addictions or their, you know, generosities. It's the art that stands quite separate from itself. And Miles helped me to learn that because he was such a hero for me as a young musician. But when I finally got a chance to meet him and chat with him, he wasn't the nice guy that I expected him to be. The guy that played Kind of Blue was not going to be my lifelong hero. And I separated the great art from the artist. And Billy teaches us and reminds us that the art is separate from the artist. And what she leaves us is a great artistic legacy. And we have to grapple with her struggles and the way in which she dealt with setbacks and comebacks. But the main thing is that she is so much more than any of that, which is why I always encourage us to deal with more than the number of divorces, the number of addictions, the number of times in and out of jail, because these are human beings.
So it strikes me as I'm listening to you talk about that, Dwight. Billie Holiday, were it not for the pain, she might not have been a great artist that she is. We hear her life in her voice. And yeah, and sadly, it's the pain that helps inform her artistry. In some ways, that's sort of like Judy Garland.
Yes.
Whose work we admire and whose work is deeply shaped by the pain of her existence. Dwight, Billie Holiday has become, there are so many artists today who say they were informed by the work of Billie Holiday. To name just one, Joni Mitchell.
Absolutely.
Says she listened to Billie Holiday's music and it shaped her approach to music. And there are so many others.
Absolutely. And that's what I think is her real legacy, is the way in which she's helped to influence others, one, to find their own voice, and to come through her voice to find their own voice. And there's so many other artists, contemporary artists. The text of these songs now have become the resources for many hip-hop artists, etc. They're rediscovering her. The thing that I always want to encourage young artists to think about is that you don't have to go down the same valley to come to reach the mountaintop. And I think you're right, Bill. I think without having the experience of being Black in America, we wouldn't have the blues. Mm-hmm. And the blues has profoundly shaped American musical expression. Yeah. But it had to come through what it meant to be Black in a world that made no place for you except as a Negro.
Terry, the final song in the show is
Deep Song.
What does it tell? What does it say? And why is it so profoundly moving to you, which you've said it is?
Unrequited love. You know, she, just like a Miles, she was not always the nicest person in the room, but she had a big heart. She had a soft heart. She always longed for love. She longed to have children. All she ever wanted was a beautiful home, you know, some sense of normalcy. And yet she was never able to achieve that. And that's what that song talks about. She says that. She said, I want a home. I want kids. I want to be able to cook. I want a club. I just want to be able to sing for my friends. And then comes that song. Lonely grief is haunting me, like a lonesome shadow taunting me.
As we go out, we're going to listen to Billie Holiday singing Deep Love. And I just want to take a moment to thank you, Dwight Andrews, for being with us today. Terry Burrell, Lady Day at Emerson's Bar and Grill, is playing downtown Atlanta, theatrical outfit, through February 4th. We're going to post on our website a link for people to find out more information about the show. Good luck with the rest of the run of the show. Dwight, I know you've been working on some new music, and at some point you need to come back and visit with us again and talk about the music you've been composing. So thank you both very much for being here for Two Way Street today. Thank you all for listening today. Olivia Rheingold is our producer. Jenny Ament is our senior producer. I'm Bill Nigut. See you again next week for another Two Way Street.
But I hear it call, and I've got to go.